Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Ben Loftus from Harrison Consoles. But first of all, brands in songs. Yes, how many songs have big brands that are mentioned in them? Well, Bloomberg did a study to find out. They looked at the top 20 songs over the last 3 years. It's 280 songs. They found 212 brands that were mentioned. Now, what are the top ones? Well, you won't be surprised. Number one is Rolls-Royce. Number two, Ferrari. Number three, Hennessy. Number four, Porsche. Number five, Chevrolet. Number six, Lamborghini. Number seven, Bentley. Number eight, Cadillac. Number nine, Jordans. I guess they mean sneakers. Number 10, Mercedes. Number 11 is Rolex, and number 12 is Xanax. And mostly we have cars in there, and it's kind of funny because Xanax is the one that really doesn't belong, but it's mentioned in a lot of songs, apparently. Now, most of these come from hip-hop songs. However, Taylor Swift, Katy Perry, Meghan Trainor, and many other country stars especially mention brand names in their songs. So this is something that's happening. And the interesting thing is, for the most part, this isn't paid for placement. This is just mentioning the brands because they're cool or perceived cool by the artist's audience. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. The second edition of my Social Media Promotion for Musicians Handbook is now available on Amazon, iBooks, Ingram, and a bookstore near you. Also, check out my courses at bobbyosinskicourses.com. Now, from the People Will Buy Anything file, Fender has come out with two very unique guitar lines. The first is what they call the Front Row Legend Esquire, and this is made out of old seats from the Hollywood Bowl. Yeah, Hollywood Bowl got rid of their 100-year-old seats in 2014. Fender bought them up, and there's actually a pretty good reason. They were made of very old, 100-year-old, Alaskan yellow cedar. So what they did is they made Esquires. Not too many of them, but they made some Esquires out of this old, distressed lumber. You get what looks like a very distressed piece of lumber in the shape of a Fender Esquire, and it has the seat number emblazoned into it. So you have number 144 and 568 and et cetera, pretty unusual. The interesting thing here is how expensive these guitars actually are. $12,000 a piece. $12,000. Wow, a lot of dough. If that isn't enough, Fender also has come out with their Pacific Battle Guitars. 6 Strats and 5 Tellies, all made from the aluminum fuselage of a B-25 Mitchell bomber from World War II. Pretty amazing, I know. I don't know why someone would want to buy an aluminum guitar, first of all, let alone aluminum that's really old. Maybe it sounds better, I don't know. It's broken in, it's vintage. But anyway, these guitars are going for $8,800 a piece. $8,800 a piece. A lot of dough. It just goes to show you that sometimes people aren't buying instruments for what they sound like. And really, they're not even buying them for what they look like. They're buying them because of the novelty involved. And that's cool because that's a whole part of the industry that kind of lives on its own and isn't in the reality of most players. Most players will buy a guitar because they want to use it. And most collectors buy it because they want to hang it on the wall or just for bragging rights, or even for an investment. Although I'm not so sure how much guitars are worth the investment these days. I think their price has kind of peaked. That being said, if you want something unique, Fender has two very unique offerings in their Front Row Legend Esquire and their Pacific Battle Guitars. My guest today is Ben Loftus, who's been with Harrison Consoles for 18 years and has seen the evolution of the big hardware desk through that time. That said, he's one of those responsible for Harrison's innovative MixBus and MixBus 32C digital audio workstations, which may be the best-sounding DAWs on the market. Ben told me all about how important the hardware consoles actually were in developing the MixBus software in the course of our interview. We spoke via Skype from the Harrison offices in Nashville, Tennessee. Where are you from, Ben?
Well, originally I'm from Mississippi. I'm from Starkville, Mississippi, where Mississippi State University is. And I grew up in Jackson in my grade school years. And then I went to high school and college at Mississippi State University. And I went to school to become a mechanical engineer and got my degree in mechanical engineering.
That's interesting how you make a jump from there to audio.
Well, it's always been in my blood. I worked my way through college at a little hi-fi shop. I walked in there one day, and one of the salespeople played a cut off of Dark Side of the Moon through these B&W little desktop speakers, and I just suddenly became an audiophile. Like in that moment, I became like a crazy audiophile afflicted person, and that was when I was in high school, I guess. And when I started college, I hung out there so much, they finally gave me a job. And I sold a bunch of high-end speakers to these professors around town that had, plenty of money and plenty of time and inclination to get into these esoteric kind of things. So we would sit around there and listen to speakers, put all kinds of different music on and listen to different speakers. And that was how I blew, 4 years getting paid for that. It was really great, a
Yeah.
really great time in my life. Other than occasionally vacuuming the floors, I had very few responsibilities except talking to these guys and listening to music, and occasionally maybe carrying a heavy pair of speakers out to their car or to their house or whatever. And I was really into the really technical side of it. The guy that owned the shop was also a professor himself. And he was a real engineer's engineer, went to Georgia Tech, and he came out of there in the 50s. And had done all the, a lot of the military, a lot of these guys in the audio industry from that time. This kind of ties into our talk about Dave Harrison. So many of them came from the military because that's where all the work was being done with radar and sonar, and that's really audio stuff at a different wavelength. I mean, it's all figuring out frequency responses and impulse responses and that kind of thing. So anyway, he was that kind of guy, and so as part of my job, I had to replace drivers when speakers would blow up, and then I learned to bias and align cassette tape machines, not multi-track machines, but cassette tapes, I don't know, replace phono cartridges and just stuff like that. And I really wanted to get a job. I tried to get a job at Peavey, and I tried to get a job at Baldwin Piano, and I wanted to kind of be in the music, the product development or engineering side of sound and music, but I couldn't make one of those opportunities happen straight out of school. And I ended up working at a first at a factory in Mississippi that was really a terrible drudge of a place to work, making these electric motors. And then I became a welding engineer. I moved to Louisville, Kentucky. And I became a designer for these towboats up there, and then eventually became kind of a welding engineer. And I worked there several years at this shipyard, but I kept my eyes open, and eventually this spot opened for a programmer at this audio company in town that I had never heard of. They're called IED, and they made these high-end industrial audio systems like airport announcement systems and stuff like that. But they also had a studio in the building because the company also had a voiceover. Anyway, it was a typical thing. It was an audio company that was spawned by some guys that were musicians and recording engineers, but had found a more lucrative business in kind of this industrial audio thing. So anyway, I went there to show up to interview, and at this hi-fi shop I worked at, we had all these really high-end speakers, Duntech and Dunlop and B&W and all this kind of stuff. But we also had, some kind like clips. We had all the horn-loaded clip stuff. And so I had bought a pair of clip horns, which is the big, the gigantic, speakers from the 70s that are earlier than that, way earlier than that. But my pair came from the 70s, and they sit in the corner of your room. And they're just loud as all get out. I mean, you put Led Zeppelin on those things, and it just sounds, like it was supposed to. I mean, that's what people were listening to at the time, So it sounds like it was supposed to. And anyway, I really liked those. And I went to this, I went to this interview, and the software guy that interviewed me said, "Hey, what do you know about programming?" I said, "Well, you know, I did a little bit in school. I'm really into it. I like programming." It probably didn't sound like I was the guy for the job, but then we started talking about speakers. Well, he had the Altec Voice of the Theater, which was, you know, the antithesis, which was just
it's not high
rivalry. You know, it's like the football rivalry of the time was the Klipshorns versus the Altec Voice of the Theater. You know.
Yeah.
And so we got a big laugh out of joking about that. And next thing you know, we're great buddies. And I started there. And that kind of got me, that got my foot in the door of programming in the audio industry. And strangely, that was around the, one of the reasons they were hiring is this was around the year 2K, the Y2K bug. And they had this old software that was in airports and convention centers and casinos and places like that all around the world. And it was written in very old computer code that did suffer from this Y2K bug. So the first thing, one of the first things I had to do was delve into this ancient software written in BASIC and Pascal and all these, you know, really decrepit old languages and fix some of that stuff. But once I got past that and we got past those projects, I got to do some really cool stuff. I did some stuff that NASA ended up using. I made some stuff that they used over at the Fort Knox Tank Driver School.
Hmm.
And some really cool casino automated sound systems that they use at these casinos to support their shows, you know, their sort of entertainment kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, that was how I got my foot in the door, and then I became became really interested in this new operating system that came out called BIOS, which was it was some guys that had split off from Apple back when Steve Jobs left Apple.
Yeah.
There was kind of a group that peeled off around the same time and started making this new operating system that was just going to wipe the floor. I mean, just really be awesome. And I forget all the details, but I think when Steve Jobs came back to Apple, they presented that to him and said, "Look, you can take this, and this thing is great." And we were – anyway, I was getting really into that thing. And to make a long story short, Harrison was also using that operating system. And so on this board where all these proponents and all these guys that were really into this operating system were hanging out, you know, they said they were looking for somebody. And I'd been doing a lot of graphics work for the this industrial audio company. And it looked like that was going to be a perfect fit. So I moved to Nashville. And I started working on the product that became the software that drives Harrison's big film consoles. It's called IKUS.
Yeah.
And that was really successful. Harrison has been around a long time. The company's been around about 40 years. And, I wasn't around for the whole thing. I just got there right around, 2001, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
No, 2000. Anyway, they had already been on top of the world a couple of times when I got there. You know, they had huge success in the mid-70s to mid-80s with the analog music consoles.
Oh, yeah, I remember well. I worked on Harrison consoles back then.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Cool, man.
32Cs, MR4s, I remember MR3s, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was all, you know, before my time, really. But, of course, I've seen them come through the factory occasionally when they're getting fixed or, you know, upgraded or whatever. And they were on top of the world, man. I mean, Pro Tools, of course, is dominating now. But there was a time when if you went to a studio, it was more likely than not that there would be a Harrison console and either an MCI tape machine or a Studer tape machine. And that was what everybody had.
Well, didn't Dave Harrison design the MCI consoles?
Yeah, he designed the MCI consoles, and then he had he started off with this idea for the inline console design, where you have a tape machine, and instead of having your console split into two pieces or having two consoles, one where you have all your mics connected that feeds the tape machine, and then another one where the tape machine feeds back to another console, he came up with the idea of sort of merging that into one thing. So you had one channel strip, and that one channel strip could send out to the tape machine, and you could EQ that going out to the tape machine, And then when you're ready to play back from the tape machine, you could switch the EQ over and EQ that playback track. And he had a bunch of cool automated features that he wanted to implement to make all that workflow a lot better. And Jeep Harned, who was the MCI guy, I guess just didn't want to invest that much. You know, he didn't think it was necessary. So Dave took all his ideas, these inline console ideas and all this automation that he wanted to do, and he started Harrison with that idea.
Got it. See, I never knew that. I knew that they split off. I thought it had to do with the fact that Jeep was going to sell MCI, because it wasn't that much afterwards where Sony bought it. And then, of course, it went into the ground. Sony didn't know what to do with it, but that was good for Harrison.
Yeah, that basically matches the parts of the story I've heard. Our side of the story,
yeah,
that's been passed down to me, is simply that they had an engineering falling out. You know, that Dave really thought people wanted this advanced console, and Jeep really thought people were fine with what they had.
Okay. Well, it makes sense. MCI consoles at the time were half the price or less than, you know, your typical English console, the Tridents and the Neebs and things like that. So consequently, you'd see them everywhere, especially like the 400 series originally, and then the 500 series after that. But you'd see them everywhere, and it was a price thing. So if it would have gone more automated, then the price would have gone up, and I could see where that would be an impediment, you know, a sales impediment perhaps. But really, SSL proved a few years later that's exactly what the market wanted.
That's right. Well, you know, Dave Harrison had that idea for this 32 series console. And when I say automation, what I mean is it had a lot of switches to change the routing. And SSL really glommed onto that. And they took that and ran with it. And Dave actually took off, and he decided to take it the next step and make an automated console, meaning you press a button and all the settings come back. Now, that took him a long time to develop that thing. Again, it's a little bit before my time, but I know it was in the 80s that they were developing that Series 10,
yeah,
which was the truly automated, computer-controlled automated console. And that console came out around the same time that SSL was really starting to get rolling pretty well. And the story I've heard is they would take that console to trade shows, and the Series 10 was a computer-controlled automated console, meaning you could click a button and say, go back to where I was, you know, yesterday at lunch, and every knob would go back to its previous setting. Now, there weren't that many knobs. There were like three knobs, and that could be the low EQ, mid EQ, high EQ. You know, you had little switches to choose what it would do.
Yeah.
But the point is, all of the signal flow that was happening behind that thing was recallable instantly. So you could click a button and instantly recall every setting that you had yesterday in an instant. The SSL guys came out, and they had this thing called total recall. And total recall means that they had a computer that would look at all your knobs and register their settings. And then it would pop up on a screen. Like if you said, well, tell me where I was yesterday at noon, it would show you one at a time each channel. Well, here's where you put the EQ. Here's where you put that aux. Here's where you put the, you know, this, that, and the other thing. So you'd switch all the buttons in and out and turn all the knobs until it said, okay, you're matched. And you ran across the whole console. And that was a total recall. Well, you know, that was laughable compared to the Series 10. But a couple things happened. Firstly, the brand name Total Recall was great. You know, it really stuck. The other thing is the Series 10 was $1.2 million in 1989 dollars.
Yeah, right.
Very advanced.
But that's why it caught on the film industry, though, because the film industry had deep pockets. They could afford it, and it did what they wanted where nothing else would. And I live in Burbank, so I can walk to Warner Brothers and Universal and Disney, among other major media facilities. So, and they all had, and they still do in many cases, have, you know, some sort of Harrison console for the dubbing stage.
Yeah, that's right. And that was one of those things in the audio industry. You've got to find people who need your product, you know,
yeah,
not just want it. So the music, that Series 10 was really cool. There were a few people who needed it. There were a lot of people who wanted one. but they couldn't justify that. But the film guys needed that.
Yeah.
Because they were running tracks and it would change from a gunshot one moment to, you know, violins the next, you know, and then a door slam and then a, you know, motorcycle engine or whatever. And so they're constantly having to, every scene by scene, it's having to change what it did. And they needed that technology. So, yeah, they had a, they were on top of the world with that, with the analog stuff. And then they had a really good run with live consoles. They made a, they custom made a console for Shoko. And I kind of came in right at the tail end of that. I think I saw the very last one of those consoles actually go out the door. And those were huge, man. They were on all the, all the biggest tours, U2 and Madonna, you know, back in the day, took those consoles because it was similar to the Series 10. It was an analog signal path, but it was completely digitally controlled and instantly recallable. And so that opened up all kind of new opportunities for these live shows. Now we take it for granted, you know, a digital console. Well, of course you can recall the settings, but man, nobody did that back then. They didn't. It really took an advanced production team to know what to do with that kind of stuff. And those few big time touring crews needed it. And the film guys needed it. So, you know, that again, that kind of put us on top of the world. And then we really were on top of the world with the film consoles starting about 10 years ago. And it's starting to reduce now because the fact is people don't need those anymore. Everybody wants a film console. You know, if you can have one, you want it, but it's not necessary like it was 10 years ago. And, you know, 10 years ago, Pro Tools was really only just beginning to get into these Hollywood stages that were really, they had to be up and working all the time. And they would bring in, you know, 10 Pro Tools systems to play out the tracks for a typical movie for multiple reasons. But it was a bunch of machines and something had to sum all of that together.
Yes, right.
And if you're going to do the summing, then you got to do the panning. And if you're going to do the panning, then you got to do the EQ. And if you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
So you just had to have one. I guess these days you probably can run 300 or 400 or 500 tracks on a big Pro Tools system. And if you can do that for music and dialogue and effects, then it makes the consoles less necessary. Where we still have some success is really the big facilities, the Sony and Universal, where they bring in an entirely different Pro Tools machine for the dialogue and the music and the effects. And in that case, again, as soon as you're summing two or three of these things together, then somebody's got to do the panning. And if you're doing the, you know, and then it just quickly snowballs into, well, you got to have the whole console.
Right.
So in a very few of these big places, we're still on top of the world there. But that's not necessary for every movie these days. So, you know, there's no question that the film console business is slowing down. But Harrison, as I said, this is not our first rodeo. Although I've only been there, 18 years, I guess. That's still fairly new for some of these guys.
Yeah, that's for sure. Right.
And they've seen it all. They've seen it all. You know, stuff comes, and stuff goes. So right now we're really focused on this mix bus thing, which is my baby, and it's a DAW. You know, it's.
Let's step back before we get into that. I'm curious about the rack products, and especially the 832C. How did that come about? Because that's a very unusual product.
You're talking about the filter box?
Yes.
Filters? Yeah. Well, that is an unusual product, and. We have the luxury at Harrison because we've been around a long time and we have lots and lots of designs and we kind of know how to make stuff. You know, we make big consoles, we make little stuff, we make all kinds of things in between. We can make whatever we want, really. And we had a lot of people tell us that the filters, you know, were the magic of that 32C. Not to everybody, but there were a lot of people who just thought that was the magic. And we had already made this Lineage microphone preamp, which has 8 mic preamps in it. And so one thing that we always wished we had changed about that was it didn't have meters on every channel, and it didn't have the filters. And a lot of people said, well, that's the sound. You know, you've got the 32 series mic preamp there, but you know, they think the filters were the sound. So we just thought, well, that's okay. We'll just make something and solve both those problems. So we added on an additional rack product that's 8 channels of high and low pass filters that are basically the same circuit from the 32 series console. And it's just 8 of them in a row. So when you take the Lineage and you connect it into that thing, now you've got 8 channels of vintage Harrison mic preamps, and then 8 channels of the high and low pass filters, and then some better metering. And it's kind of a little package, you know?
Yeah. Okay. I get it. All right. Let's go to Mixbus. A couple things that I want to tell you first before we get into it, because I have lots of questions here. I have lots of subscribers in a closed Facebook group, which is all for my subscribers, actually. The interesting thing is someone posted not that long ago all about Mixbus, saying this is the best thing, you know, you'll ever hear. And if you buy it and you don't like it, I will buy that version from you.
Wow.
He was doing a guarantee, a price guarantee. So when I got to try it, which is just recently, I got to say, within the first 5 seconds, I knew. That's all it took. It's like, oh yeah, this is better. It was big. It was fat. It was round. It was analog. It had an analog feel to it. And you could tell immediately, it was there without doing anything. It was just audio flowing through it. So what's the deal? How does that happen?
Thank you so much for saying that. We worked really hard on it. Well, I guess the deal is we had been doing this for a long time before we made Mixbus. I mean, I can give you a specific example. This is my favorite anecdote I like to tell about it, is those film consoles in Hollywood, when we originally sent those out, they were analog. So there was a control surface in the dubbing stage that's just a big mouse. You know, it had faders, it had motorized faders, motorized joysticks, all the knobs for the EQ, the sends, and everything. But there was no signal processing going on in there. There was just one cable that ran back to the machine room, and that was controlling these racks. I mean, 6-foot-tall racks, you know, as far as the eye could see, to control 200 or 300 channels of analog signal processing. And they were playing, you know, mag tape into these channels and making movies that way. Well, then the digital revolution came, and they changed out all those mag machines for digital playback machines of various flavors. And it was time for the consoles to become digital. So we rather selfishly decided that instead of making a whole new console and trying to sell a whole new console and potentially letting these customers look at some other options, we decided we'll go in and we'll just replace the back end with a digital back end. So all the racks would come out and be replaced. Instead of analog racks, they'd be digital racks. So the studios would get the digital processing that they needed to match up to their digital processing, their digital playback, and, you know, reduce noise floor. I mean, they were getting up into these hundreds of channel counts. I mean, it doesn't matter how good, you know, your system is. When you're adding 100 channels, the noise builds up.
Yeah.
And as these things got more and more complicated, that was really becoming a problem. So we made a digital back end. But what's weird about that I can't think of any other example anywhere else, is there were mixers who mixed on Friday afternoon or Saturday, and they were turning a knob, and it was an analog sound. And then they had to come in on Monday morning, mixing the same picture, and turn the knob, and it had to sound the same.
Yeah.
I mean, they literally, we changed it out. You know, their management changed it out from under them from analog to digital. And, you know, maybe I'm exaggerating. They might have not done it in one project. Maybe they spanned a couple of projects. But the point is, they had their muscle memory. They had their ear training. These were really high-level professional guys that were used to their analog back end to make these very high-end movies in really some of the most expensive rooms. I mean, the rooms at places like, you know, Sony and Universal. I mean, there are a lot of great music studios in the world, but well, you know, I mean, you've been there.
Yeah.
This is really high end
stuff. Yeah, right. No, it's another level.
Though, A whole different level.
Yeah.
So this is those guys, you know, those guys with those ears, they're mixing with the analog system one day, and then they have to come in and mix on digital. And it was our job to not screw them up. You know, I mean, it had to, the knobs had to all operate the same. When you sweep, it had to sweep at the same rate and have the same, you know, and sweep smoothly. And it had to sound analog. So that was a really hard product to launch. It took a lot of engineers quite a long time to dial that in. And once we had done that once, then we knew how to do it. And I'm not sure that anybody else ever had to do that.
Yeah, right.
So sit down at Mixbus. It's not a million-dollar console. It doesn't do everything that the million-dollar console does. You know, it doesn't have the horse. It's got the horsepower of one computer, whereas our big consoles have, you know, dozens of computers back there doing all the processing. But it was written by the same guys who had learned all those techniques going from the analog into the, you know, making a digital version of an analog console. So we had already figured out what not to do, you know, to make something sound digital. We needed to make it all work so that it still sounded analog, which is, you can never make anything sound better. The point is not to make it sound worse.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so we took those consoles and we made the digital engine sound like the analog engine.
What's the difference between Mixbus and Mixbus 32C?
The differences are very small. The only difference in the product is the 32C has a bigger blown up EQ. Maybe a better way to go about it is just kind of to tell you the story. I mean, when we first launched Mixbus, we had a big advantage. We had launched these previous consoles, the Series 10, the Series 12, the MPC, the LPC, and those consoles had computers that controlled them and knew every setting, every compressor, every EQ, everything. And, you know, occasionally we would get those settings files from users, either because they had a problem or because they wanted to show us something or because they sent a console in and we had the settings or whatever it was. We could see those settings or we would ask them for them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to compile a tremendous amount of information. So we know, for example, that a 3-band EQ and a high-pass filter will do 90% of what anybody ever did to make a great record.
Makes sense.
You know?
Sure. Yeah.
And the compressors, three different compressor settings. One that's kind of a really low ratio, very fast release. Another one that's kind of a middle ratio with a program-dependent release. And then another one that's a really fast, high-ratio limiter type thing. With those three settings, man, you can do like 95% of every compressor, everything anybody ever tried to do, because you're doing the task. You're doing the task, you know. It's sort of the task that an LA-2A, you know, leveler does. Or a XYZ, you know, name your thing.
Leveler mode is great, by the way. That's awesome.
Oh, you put it on everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which everybody, of course, everybody loves to do that. So we knew that. We knew that everybody put that setting on everything. You know, we had those documents. We had that proof that this is what real guys do. So we took all that information. We made Mixbus. We made a 3-band EQ with a high pass filter, a very simple compressor. And, you know, from our standpoint, that was kind of the end of the story. It was kind of like, well, let's just dip our toes into this DAW thing. You know, let's just put the minimum stuff that gets the job done for most people and see if it takes off. And man, we made a big splash. I mean, Mixbus version 1, we had no idea how crazy that was going to go, on some of these forums and things. We really, honestly, were unprepared for it, with a version 1 product. I guess we should have anticipated that since we're Harrison, you know, I mean, we probably should have anticipated how that was going to go a little better, but we didn't realize we were going to get adopted by so many people so fast. But what did happen out of that is a lot of people didn't understand why we didn't make the 32C EQ, because there was already a plug-in out. In fact, one of the reasons we made Mixbus was Universal Audio had chosen to model that 32 series EQ.
Yeah.
And also Dan Kennedy over at Great River made a 500 module of that 32 series EQ.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a reminder to us that music guys still knew we were around. You know, they still knew that. They knew that sound. They still wanted that. So anyway, Mixbus was kind of our, you know, I don't know what you can say. First product, first foray into that kind of back into music, I guess I would say. And a lot of people didn't understand why we didn't make the 32C EQ in there. And they also asked us, well, what console is it modeled on? Well, we weren't in the business of modeling stuff, really. I mean, I guess you could say we modeled those analog consoles, but the point is we make the consoles. We don't model stuff.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we make the first ones. So here, the Harrison Mixbus was kind of the first of a new thing. But a lot of people really expected that 32 series EQ. And then we did eventually pick up a few of our fans, our older Harrison experienced users, and they knew where to turn each of those knobs with the 32C. And they kind of made a convincing argument that we should do the 32C EQ. So we did actually model that circuit and put the 32C EQ in. And then we also kind of sweetened the deal by adding some additional buses. Mixbus itself is sort of intentionally limited to 8 stereo buses, which again was sort of enough, you know, for most music projects. You can have as many tracks as you want, but then you had these 8 sort of effects and or subgroup buses. And from our research, we thought that would be enough for 90% of the projects you'd ever do. So we kind of sweetened the pot with 32C, and we went out to 12 stereo buses, which really does accommodate, you know, the vast majority of what people are trying to do.
That's plenty. And, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for a music project. Now, I mean, you wouldn't take this into a film stage, you know.
Yeah.
That's not what it's for. But for recording a band and subgrouping some things and sending some things out to reverbs, you know, it's great. It's more than enough. It's everything you need right under your fingertips. And so basically that's the difference. 32, 30 Mixbus is sort of the entry level that does 90% of everything you'd want to do. If you want to go bigger than that, then you might have to add some plugins or whatever. And then 32C has the full 4-band EQ with the high and low pass filter. And now you're talking about very rarely needing a plug-in EQ.
Who is the customer for this?
Well, we've found that we have 2 or 3 different, very different customers. One customer that we knew we were going to get was the really techie, computery, Linux open source kind of person. And there's a reason why I say that. It's because we started the Mixbus project. I guess I could go back and tell the story, but maybe it's not important. But we started it as a collaboration with this open source group to make a totally different product. And Mixbus sort of came out as a side effect of that. And we published it almost at their request. I'll just tell you a little piece of the story.
Yeah.
So we're working on these film consoles, and they needed a destructive recorder to match the old mag machines they used to record to. And the idea is at the end of the day, you would record your whole mix to this mag machine, to this tape, multi-track tape machine, and it had your music and your dialogue and your effects, and it had the stereo mixes of all that and the 5.1 mixes, and you know, it's quite a lot of tracks. It could be 48, 64 tracks or something like that that you're mixing at the end of the day for the film. And they would print that to this machine, and then the director would come in and he would say, that spoon clank, it's really blowing the mood in scene 47. And the door slam really needs to be more ominous and darker in scene 96, you know? And so they'd rewind back. They would get all their effects back to the settings they used to have. And they just punch in that short little section. And then they'd hand over the tape. Done. You know, they don't have to roll through the whole half movie again. You know, that was their workflow. So we made this product because Pro Tools would not do that. Pro Tools had a really terrible implementation of this destructive recording mode. And we came out with that and we launched it at NAB. And we did that by collaborating with this open source group. But at the same NAB show, Pro Tools came out with version 8 and they had fixed the bugs that had plagued people for so long that everybody said, oh, they'll never get around to fixing that. You know, we've asked them 100 times, they'll never do it. Well, they did it. And so really that product, our product was kind of dead in the water. And the side effect of that was the open source guys said, hey, why don't you make us an EQ plugin and a compressor plugin? And we spent a little bit of time doing that, and we realized that didn't feel like a console at all. It just didn't feel, just adding an EQ plugin didn't mix. It didn't turn it into a mixer, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So we, or I guess I should say I got this bee in my bonnet to sort of put a real mixer into a DAW. And so we sort of made this, yeah, I mean, it was honestly just kind of a proof of concept, but I had spent so much time on it, we kind of had to launch it. And so we launched this MixBus thing. And so part of our user base is that are those people. The other part of our user base are the guys that really wanted an analog console. You know, they want an analog, they want that magic of that analog sound. And that really describes almost everybody starting from 2010 until now, I guess.
Yeah.
That's just a really desirable thing. And then maybe there's a third group, which are sort of like studio guys that can't get what they need done with other tools. Because MixBus, I mean, every workstation is a little different. Everybody does, you know, a few things a little different. And MixBus has a couple of tricks up its sleeve that are just our things, you know. Mm-hmm. The way the editor works, the way you can layer stuff, the way the crossfades between the different clips work. You know, for example, you can take a plugin and put it post fader. So you can drag a plugin down below the fader, and that makes it post fader.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so I mean, just a couple of subtle but super cool things that a few of our guys have sort of glommed onto. And once you learn a trick like that, you know, you can never change.
Yeah, right, right.
So I guess that's who it is. You know, there's a group of sort of techie guys. There's the guys that are looking for the analog sound to do their mixes, and I would say that most of those guys are really audio engineers. I mean, these are mixing and mastering type dudes.
Well, you know, there's a real need in the marketplace, or I should say desire in the marketplace, to replace Pro Tools. People are getting fed up with the subscription. They don't feel like, in the grand scheme of things, that Avid has kept up with the rest of the marketplace. And it wouldn't take much to have a lot of people switch. In post, it's different. In post, you know, that's pretty entrenched, and it's really difficult if you have a facility that has 200 seats of anything to get them to switch. But in music, it wouldn't take much at all to get a lot of that marketplace to switch. So I think now is a good time to actually be coming up with this. The 32C is pretty new, right?
Yeah, 32C is, I guess, maybe a little over a year old now.
Okay. I've played with it, but I haven't played with it a lot, so I'm by no means an expert, and I don't have all that much insight into it. I'm going to get more, believe me, because I'm going to do some projects on it because I'm so interested in it, and it does sound so good.
Cool.
But yeah, that being said, you mentioned a couple of things that were unique to MixBus, and one of them, of course, was the post fader with the inserts. And what's the other one you mentioned?
Well, boy, you kind of put me on the spot. The other one I mentioned was the way that the editor works. You know, in Pro Tools, let's say you have one long take, you have a take of let's say it's a guitar take, you know, and now you want to go punch over the second half of a solo. So you punch in on that section, and now you have another clip there through the second half of the solo.
Right.
Now, if you just theoretically, you know, if you grab that clip and you drag it a little bit to the left, then you'll see like a hole open up on the right side because you've sort of overwritten that, right?
Yeah, right.
And MixBus is not alone in this, but I think we have one of the better implementations where we actually have sort of a stack of layers. Just like in an image editing app, you can have, you know, a black circle on top of red circle on top of a green circle, mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
And the edges of those circles are transparent. I mean, they can be made transparent so that they sort of blur into each other. You can see some of the, you know, some of the green one behind the red one and some of the black one behind that, right? So we've got these layers. So if you grab that clip in MixBus, a couple of things happen. Firstly, if you drag it and drag it left, you'll just uncover the previous take. So if you start to trim.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, you start to trim, you're just sort of uncovering what was underneath there,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So you can trim this thing. And then the cool bit is at the top and tail of every clip, there's a crossfade. And you can stretch or shrink that crossfade to crossfade into whatever is in the layer below that clip. And it's even cooler than that, because when you grab this clip and you drag it, it becomes visibly transparent. Boy, this is something where a podcast really suffers.
Yeah, right.
I could really show you something. You know, I could really show you something cool if we had a picture. But when you drag this clip, it becomes visibly transparent, and you see the waveform below it. So, like, if you're trying to take a verse and paste it in where another verse was, you can find like the snare drum transient and drag this thing forward and back until they literally stack visually. Like, the one underneath sort of disappears because the line of the waveform stacks on it.
Yeah.
Then you know you've got the timing exactly right. And it's just a really fast way to line stuff up and edit. And then you have these crossfades. So you can do some really cool stuff. For example, in Pro Tools, like in almost every DAW, a crossfade is sort of defined as the junction between two wave files. You know, this one ends and the next one begins. And now how wide do you want to mix them?
Yeah, right.
Well, in MixBus, every clip has a fade. Just like, you know, in Pro Tools and in Nuendo, everybody, they all have these fade handles where you can fade in and out at the end of a clip, right?
Yeah.
But in ours, that's actually a crossfade from whatever is below. So in normal day-to-day work, that's a fade in from silence. It's a crossfade from silence, so it just sounds like a fade in.
Yeah.
But if you had some stuff under there, like imagine the case that you've painstakingly created this series of drum hits, and now you want to bring in something else. You can lay this layer, this region, on the top layer on top of all those 17 edits that you made, and make a long fade, and you'll fade from, you know, underneath the long clip, there's these 17 little edits, and all that will play back, and then this will fade into it and take it over.
That's awesome.
I'm not sure I can do it justice. Without
no,
a picture,
I understand. I know what you're talking about. I understand. In the meantime, last question, Ben. It's a little off of the subject, but appropriate nonetheless. What's the best piece of business advice that maybe somebody imparted to you or you learned along the way?
Ooh, man. I suppose there's the old adage, you know, it's better to keep a customer than to go find a new one.
That's good, though.
And I guess, it's funny to say that, but that ties in perfectly with what I was talking about with the film guys. You know, we didn't want to lose those customers. That's why we didn't make them buy a whole new console. Boy, the more I think about it, that was a great question. Boy, Bobby, you gave me a softball. Because, you know, there is a problem in today's culture where you use your iPhone a couple of years and you throw it away because there's one, you know, way better. Or Pro Tools is another great example. I mean, they're pretty aggressive about making sure that you upgrade.
Yes, they are. Yeah.
To even, you know, otherwise it just stops working. And Harrison actually has a very long and very stable history of taking care of customers in a completely different way. You can literally go to Universal Studios today and you will be sitting at knobs and faders that were there in 1990. That's 27, no, not 90. It hasn't been 27 years, but it's been a long darn time.
Yeah.
When did that console go in? That would have been, like 90, 94, I think. I'm not the guy to say because I wasn't there, but it was long before my time. And that board has been there for, you know, well over 20 years now. Now it's been upgraded slightly, but they never had to make that big capital investment again. You know, we didn't make them take the whole thing out and put a new one in.
Yeah,
every 5 years.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I think that is a very fundamental difference in the way maybe we do things.
It is a different way to do business, but I think it's the right way. It's the way I prefer to do. By the way, your tutorials are fantastic.
Oh, thank you. I think they were sort of made for, I guess, sort of clued in people. We do get some requests, hey, can't you just give me something really entry level? But we kind of took the approach that most people who buy a MixBus have probably already used a DAW, and they just want to know what's different,
yeah,
you know, and what's special. What's, So I'm glad to hear you say that. You're actually the kind of person that we made those for, and I'm really glad to hear you say that.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. There is some entry-level stuff, but it's the right stuff, I think. And I was impressed. I didn't watch them all, but I watched enough of them to understand that, boy, that's going in the right direction for sure. To learn more about Harrison's Mixbus, go to Harrison Consoles, all one word, harrisonconsoles.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter for alerts to new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.